You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Wednesday, 5 November. We've got ARM results after US market close today. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Simthembile Phephela, FNB Wealth and Investments. The Optasia listing yesterday, no pop, well, up 38 cents, 2%. But the question is there value? And maybe that lack of pop gives us opportunity. Martin Ackerman from Citadel, we've got the medium-term budget policy statement next week. Expectations? I'm curious, inflation targets, tax, government of national unities, we'll get his view. And then Harry Schweizer from Future Forex. We're off the grey listing, but FX transactions are under increased scrutiny and we need to protect ourselves. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headline, MoneyWeb, bankers raking up to 416 million rand in Optasia JC listing. Advisor originally hired to explore the sale IPO nets 199 million rand. Business day, Treasury withdraws proposal to tax foreign retirement income. Morning markets are red. US was down 1.2%. S&P down 1.2%. Nasdaq down 2.1%. In the East, red. Sydney off 0.6%. Tokyo down a little over 4%. Hong Kong down just over 0.5%. And Tencent half a percent lower. Commodities all red. Gold futures 3,962. Brent 64.14. Platinum 1,539. Palladium 1,413. The rand is 17. Bitcoin 102,000. Top 40 opening call, red open, but 120 points, or just over a tenth of a percent lower.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Joining now with Simthembile Phephela, investment research analyst at FNB Wealth and Investments. Simthembile, appreciate the early morning. Lots of excitement around the Optasia listing yesterday. Biggest listing of the year by some measure. IPO was 19 Rand. It opened at, 20.75, closed the day 19.38. So only up some 2%. Maybe not the pop that everyone was expecting or hoping for on listing. But your thoughts on the opportunity here? And Optasia as an investment, and maybe the lack of pop gives people a second chance, because I don't know, my allocation, I only got 14% of what I applied for.
Morning, Simon. Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. There was definitely a lot of excitement around this one. So I think that a lack of a sort of first day surge is a bit of not necessarily a downer, but it wasn't what we were anticipating. But I don't think it necessarily means that there isn't value here. I think it perhaps reflects sort of realistic pricing rather than hype. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, you know, it listed at 19 a share, giving it market cap of about 23.5 billion. So definitely quite a substantial listing on the JSE and an offer that was oversubscribed. So I think the muted reaction likely stems from perhaps investors weighing a couple of things. There's huge growth potential here, but also some execution risk. Mm-hmm. On the positive side, you know, Optasia is an established global fintech with operations across, you know, various geographies. They've built an AI-driven platform that effectively plugs credit products into mobile ecosystems. And, you know, they've got very significant partnerships with MTN and Vodacom in this respect. So people can access these nano loans instantly through their mobile phones. So there's a massive opportunity when you consider that 52% of adults in Africa are still unbanked, yet SIM penetration is near 90% and growing. So, you know, Optasia has already accessed, or rather processed, 82 million credit decisions daily, and has disbursed 20 billion in microloans since 2016. So the growth runway is quite real. I think perhaps where there is some risk sentiment is around customer concentration. They rely heavily on a few big partners, as I already mentioned, MTN and Vodacom, but also Jazz Cash in Pakistan. And if, you know, these partners renegotiate contracts or switch providers, Upstage's revenue could take a big hit. But there's also the credit risk elements. You know, the Optasia underwrites defaults, the first loss default risk, which means they bear all the default risk on these micro loans. And this is, you know, we're talking about the unsecured space.
Yeah.
And so provisions, you know, for these expected credit losses are quite substantial, and their biggest cost item. The AI-driven credit scoring at the scale in terms of customer volumes, but also in terms of loan size, that's what has enabled them to sort of maintain relatively low default rates so far, below sector averages. But of course, a spike in defaults could hurt profitability. But that being said, you know, the short loan cycles is what allows them to stop lending quickly in an event of some kind of catastrophe event like the pandemic or some other financial crisis. So there are sort of mitigating strategies in place for that. They've also been able to operate with very low gearing because of their funding relationships with financial institutions. And part of the core investment case for Optasia, I think, is that they can offer these instant sort of access to credit services while limiting over-indebtedness due to their AI-driven risk profiling. So they've been able to reach under-penetrated markets that for banks would just be not necessarily economical, since, you know, the loan disbursements are quite high in frequency, but also very low in value. So I think there's definitely some upside here in the story. Sure, you know, the there wasn't a listing pop per se, and that's fine. I don't think that's necessarily a red flag in and of itself. I think, you know, the real question is whether Optasia can deliver on its promise of financial inclusion at scale, because that's the story here. You know, we've seen that inclusion is profitable. But, you know, so if you believe that story and can sort of stomach the volatility that may be there, I think there is value here.
Yeah. And most of the folks I've spoken to, analysts and the like, they're saying around about a 25, I mean, there's some different views, but around about a 25 rand value. We'll leave it there. Sintabile Boipelo from FNB Wealth and Investments. And that's our poll today on LinkedIn and Twitter. Is there opportunity here? Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for three decades.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Martin Ackerman, Chief Economist at Citadel. Martin, medium-term budget policy statement, Wednesday 12th coming up. What are we looking for from this? This really is, I mean, the budget, we all understand, that's February. The minister tells us what they're going to spend and receive and the like. What are we expecting from this medium-term budget policy statement?
Yes, well, the first thing we hope to see is that we actually get a budget presented. Remember that in February we had three versions. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why this one is so late, because it's normally in October. But having said that, in February, it was really gloomy. You know, we were still wondering what the impact is going to be from Trump.
Yeah.
Our growth numbers looked quite bleak. The debt metrics were very much under pressure. That's exactly why they wanted to table a VAT increase, because we had a shortfall of about 60 billion. And the bond yields were, you know, touching 11%. Clear reflection that, you know, the market is concerned about sustainability of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Now, fast forward to where we are right now, and I think the minister is going to have a little bit of an easier job. Having said that, you know, we're not out of the woods yet. So we're all aware of the commodity tailwind we had. So that definitely helped in terms of lifting some of the tax revenue. So there's a bit of relief there.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like the government is sticking to budget prudence, trying to cut back or at least manage the expenses. And our growth there and thereabouts, maybe a little bit higher in terms of where we've been at the beginning of this year. Still not good enough. You know, we're talking one and a bit. We will really solve the budget issues if we can get growth closer to 2.5. But if you put all of that into the mix, yeah, I think it is going to be at least a stepping stone for the minister to be able to give a little bit of a better picture. But the big concern is, you know, you can't just rely on this to continue on the back of the commodity cycle. That can be gone tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
So they need to give proper guidance and updates. Like you said, this is an update in terms of where we are in terms of the plans going forward, especially that tail disappears.
Yeah, you chatted a couple of weeks ago about that tax income thanks to precious metal. It's great, but to your point, it can go as quickly as possible. The Government of National Unity, I mean, that was something that the minister has said post the failed attempts at the beginning of the year, where he would engage with the other partners in the Government of National Unity. And it's sort of at this point in the process, which means that it sort of makes it smoother sailing and get everyone on the same page so we don't have a repeat of the two failed attempts for the budget this year. Is there any sense that this is happening, or do we just, you know, sort of take him at his word in that regard?
Yeah, I think he won't make that same mistake. You know, it was very clear that's not going to work. And, you know, there was even some of the internal ANC members that weren't aware of some of those changes. So I think he will do that to his detriment if he doesn't include all of them in terms of any plans that he wants to talk about. After that, they obviously had some other challenges or tests in terms of the Government of National Unity. And just this weekend, you know, the leaders met. And so I think, you know, there's a willingness to pull in the right direction and make sure that we can execute on the policy. I think this budget will be part of that, to show that there's a commitment in terms of doing the right things to get the growth on the right trajectory.
We've got the Reserve Bank governor continually going on about inflation target. The MPC says they are anchoring at 3%. The finance minister pushed back and said it was his call. And it is his call, make no mistake about it. Does he talk around it then, or does he leave it for the big day in Feb?
Yeah, I think that is obviously a debate at the moment between the Treasury and Reserve Bank. You're 100% right that the mandate comes from the Treasury to the Reserve Bank. And then the governor needs to accept that mandate and execute on that. So, yeah, I don't think there will be any big announcement at this point in time. You know, there's still a lot of legwork that needs to be done to decide on a formal framework. So I expect, if anything, that will probably be at the later budget.
And that's the thing with this, well, usually October, as you said, this year, a little later in November. This isn't really a big policy. This is more a guidance of, you know, updating on what we said last February and maybe giving a bit of guidance towards next year's budget. There's no sort of, my sense is, sort of big announcements or anything at this medium-term policy statement.
Yeah, it's normally an update. So an update in terms of the growth dynamics, the debt dynamics, the deficit, debt to GDP. Typically don't get any tax announcements or major policy changes. So it is almost pulling the dipstick out and see whether the oil is where you think it is, and then basically give guidance for the latter part of the fiscal year.
A last question. We got off the grey list, what, about 10, 12 days ago or so. I see Bank of America suggesting that we might actually get an upgrade by S&P during November. To be clear, we would still be sub-investment grade. I mean, do our minds now turn to that potential upgrades from the major rating agencies? Is that something we can expect in the near term?
Well, definitely moving in that direction. So the grey list is totally independent from that. You know, that is about dealing with corruption and money laundering. And the rating agencies are saying, well, is the government running? But yeah, ticking all those boxes definitely make a difference. And if you just look at where our bond yields are out now, the market is telling us, you know, you're in a much better position. Like I've said, we were close to 11% in February, we're now dipping below 9%.
Yeah.
But, you know, the rating agencies, they won't just upgrade you simply after one budget or a little bit of a tail. They need a couple of years of seeing that we are moving into a more sustainable environment, and then they'll start doing that. So we might get view updates in terms of stable potential for being upgraded, but I think it's a little bit too early to actually see a change yet.
Yeah, and the key thing is that 2%, almost 2% move in the bond yields is a big move for bonds. We'll leave it there. That's Martin Ackerman, Chief Economist at Citadel. Appreciate the time. Let your money weather the storms with StanLib Asset Management. Invest in the StanLib Global Select Fund, a diversified all-weather equity portfolio sub-managed by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Harry Schoser, CEO of Future Forex. Harry, appreciate the early morning again. International money transfers, they become, I suspect, increasingly common. 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, we never really did them. Now they're part of our daily lives, but they still feel perhaps overly complex, full of red tape. And truthfully, post getting off the grey listing, even more so as we sort of try and remove the potential for fraud here. It is a complex process. We need to do it properly, though.
Yeah, hey Simon, great to chat to you this morning. And I echo what you say completely. I mean, it's a matter of, while it is extremely complex for South Africa in particular because of exchange controls, the truth is if we don't do our relevant KYC as providers, if we don't ensure that the people that are sending money are clean, we're going to find ourselves straight back on the grey list. So really, yeah. I think it's a bit of a necessary evil, if that makes sense.
It does. And it's not even back on the grey list. It could just be that you find your money disappearing if you use a fly-by-night. And the point is, I mean, a proper provider, a proper FX, someone who can do the transactions, they're going to have a bunch of regulations. Who are the sort of overseers that we would need to look for to make sure that they are suitably regulated?
Yeah, so the big one is the FSCA. So mm-hmm. if someone says they have an FSP license or more recently a CASP license, which is a crypto asset service provider mm-hmm. license, I would firstly verify that. I wouldn't take someone's word yeah. for it. You can very easily verify that on the FSCA's website. So this is a great first port of call. But if you're looking for gold standard, there are two other mm-hmm. Licenses you can look for. The one is something called a treasury outsourcing company, which basically gives someone the right to send money out the country as a company. So being an FSP doesn't necessarily mean you have the ability to send someone's money out the country. And then finally, you want someone to be an accountable institution, which means that they're regulated by the Financial Intelligence Center, the FIC. And if you have all three of those, if your provider has all three of those, it becomes far less likely that they're going to run away with your money. Because if they do, I'm not saying they won't with certainty, sure. but if they do, at least you've got someone to be accountable to and say, hold on, you licensed these guys. You said that they were legitimate. So if they don't have those three things, I think I'd be very, very scared to give anyone a cent of my money, quite frankly.
Yeah, okay. So FSCA, SOB, and then FIC, Financial Intelligence mm-hmm. Center. The other thing as well, which might tempt some people, I mean, there are fees involved, and those fees can vary widely, and we might be tempted. Sometimes if it's too good to be true, it isn't true. The thing is that a lot can be hidden in the fees, and if you're going to do it, we really do need a complete breakdown of those costs up front. Is that a fair request mm-hmm. to say to a provider, you know, what are all the costs, including spreads and all the other bits and pieces that can be hidden?
Yeah, so Simon, now we're going one level up. Now we're going to providers that are in fact regulated, yes. but actually choose not to be fully transparent. And in my view, this is what I've been fighting for a long time in this industry, is that it's the one industry which is completely un-customer-centric. It's business-centric. So effectively, it's almost standardized to hide fees. And the big one to hide is the spread. So what tends to happen is banks and other Forex providers will tell you very explicitly about the processing fee, they might call it, or some fixed nominal fee of 500 Rand, 1,000 Rand, whatever it is. But what they'll leave out intentionally is the spread, the fact that over and above this, you might be being charged a rate which is 2% worse than the spot rate. And on a million Rand, 2% is 20,000 Rand.
Yeah.
The reason they hide that is that if they invoiced you 20,000 Rand, you'd say, thanks, I'll go elsewhere. And so effectively, they've intentionally shown you the smaller fee, but left out the bigger fee. And you asked, are you entitled to say, what's my spread? You are entitled to say this, but my problem is that you shouldn't need to say it. And even if you do, not all providers are going to tell you explicitly. They're going to say, oh, it varies, it changes. There's going to be ways they're going to move around it, which is something that's a big gripe for me, because as a financial industry, we should be putting that all up front and telling every single client exactly what they're paying overall and why.
Yeah, and those numbers can get, I mean, I've seen, I mean, what, they're around 1750 now. There are some places out there around where I stay where, I mean, they're probably charging 18, 10, 16, 90. I mean, the 2% yeah. number at times actually might be generous. And to your point, on $1 million, that's 20,000. It is proper. We'll leave it there. Harry Souza, CEO, Future Forex, appreciate the early morning. That's it for today. We're chatting with Petra Edenhess yesterday, Herenia Capital Advisors. Gold, it's holding around 4,000. It actually slipped a little bit today or yesterday. We asked him and you if it was time to buy gold. Would you expect more downside? Petra was saying there's lots flashing green and he is expecting more upside potential. And about 40% of them about 40% of you agreed with him. It's going to run. The rest was split between no more downside and others saying I'm still holding. Have your vote. Have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Offshore Income Active ETF.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.